Welcome to Fermentality. I'm your host, Kat Pierce with Atlantic Brew Supply, and we're homebrewers talking homebrew and sharing fermentation. All right, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So I have a very special episode for you guys here today. We actually have Andrew here from Raleigh Brewing Company. He is one of the brewers for Raleigh Brewing, and he is a QC QA extraordinaire. He has decided to join us today to talk about setting up your own lab at home and what that looks like. So, Andrew, thank you again for joining us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in brewing and in beer?
Let's start with the how I got involved. So I started homebrewing with my dad when I was a teenager. My dad homebrewed beer, my mom and dad together, they did wine and mead. And I just kind of picked it up from there. I also learned from my dad and my older brother what was good beer and what wasn't. And you might be able to tell from the accent that that meant cask beer from a beer engine. I was interested in the brewing industry from there. I did my degree in biochemistry with a specialization in molecular biology, and I was considering at the time going into the brewing industry. But the breweries at the time were all the big conglomerates. It was time of a lot of consolidation in the brewing industry, so there wasn't really any good small craft breweries that really had anything I could get into there. And definitely on the lab side, not the brewing side. So I took a different path and got into the biotechnology end of pharma biotech kind of thing. So I spent my career as a molecular biologist working with plants, mammalian cells, making humanized monoclonal antibodies, working with yeast to produce human biotherapeutic proteins. And from that, ultimately, I moved over to the US, working for a startup company, again, using yeast to make human proteins. And ultimately was a co-founder of a biotech company that got bought by Pfizer.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to retire at about the age of 45. I was looking around for, what I'm going to do next and that kind of stuff. And I'd moved down here to just outside Durham by that point. And it was when craft beer was just taking off around here. Pop the Cap had happened, and I sort of cut my notice. I'd also noticed that there was a bunch of homebrew shops popping up, and that we had access to a lot more variety of grain and yeast and all that kind of thing. When I first started homebrewing, everybody used to complain that all homebrew tasted the same, and it did because we were all using the same crappy yeast. And that was probably one of my first realizations was when I actually got my hand on some yeast from the Ruddles Brewery in the Midlands in England for a great beer at the time called Ruddles County. And I brewed with that. And same ingredients, same method and everything. And the results were night and day. One tasted like beer, one tasted like homebrew. And that's when I really started to realize that, there was a lot more to homebrewing and being able to get great flavor and taste out of it. And now, nowadays you have more choice than you can comfortably shake a stick at as far as yeast options go.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the amount of yeast that we even just carry in the shop. I mean,
yeah,
we probably have at least, 150, if I were to guess, the top of my head.
And there's more coming out all the time. There's, you just look at the kind of work that Omega are doing with the stuff they've just published now with the hazy yeast, finding the hazy yeast gene, being able to reverse engineer non-hazy strains to make them hazy and vice versa. There's a a bunch of yeast companies that are doing some really interesting work.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So you are actually here to help us determine why homebrewers should have a lab. But why would a homebrewer want a lab, or why should they have an at-home lab?
It's a really interesting question. I've been thinking about that a lot since you asked me to come and talk about this. And I guess the answer really is because you can. And there's all kinds of different levels of what you can do. And some of that's going to be based on experience. I have a lab at home, but I have a level of experience of working in a lab where I know what to set up. I know where to get the equipment from. I kind of know what I'm doing without thinking about it. But somebody coming into it fresh, it's, you know, you've got to take steps to slowly work up to it. Just like everything else in homebrewing, it can get real expensive real fast if you let it, you know, take you for the ride. All of a sudden you find you've spent a lot of money on a lot of equipment and you're like, oh my God, how did that happen? But I think you really have to decide what it is you want to do. There's a number of things you can look at doing. Maybe you're wanting to resurrect yeast from a bottle beer and you want to try and get that yeast and to reuse it. That's getting harder and harder to do because companies that do bottle condition their beer realize that every man and his dog is stealing their yeast. So now they use a generic conditioning yeast. But there's some of the wild ferments where you can resurrect those the yeast and bacteria that might be in those bottles. And also maybe isolating from the wild and that kind of thing. And we can get into a little bit more detail on that kind of thing as we talk about equipment and that kind of stuff. You also have to have some expectations around that. Like if you're trying to resurrect from a bottle, you're never going to be able to recreate exactly that beer, because if it's a mixed culture, some things are going to survive and some things aren't. So right. You'll never get the same representative culture. Like a lambic, one of the early stages of lambic production is you have enteric bacteria in there in the cool ship, and they're making what are generally considered off flavors, but they are flavor precursors when you stick them in a foder and age them for 3 years. But as soon as the pH drops below 4.5, as soon as the oxygen goes away, those bacteria are dead. So you are never going to recover those. You're never going to get that same part of the culture. So you can resurrect those things. You can keep them alive, but you're not going to get the same effect. Similarly, isolating from the wild, the best time of year to do that is probably around now. You have a lot of fruit on the trees. You have, you know, grapes in vineyards. And that's where you're going to see yeast blooms on fruits that you can capture from the wild. And the main vectors for transporting wild yeast are wasps and fruit flies. Everybody thinks that, you know, brewer's yeast are just floating around in the air. They're not. They don't have the kind of projections on the spores and on the cells that would have them wafting around in the wind. It's been shown that not only do wasps particularly transport them around, but wild yeast overwinter in their guts. And so when you have a vineyard that is using wild yeast, that's where they're coming from. Those wasps in the local nest that are continually reinfecting those grapes. And there was a study that showed that it was only 1 in 1,000 grapes in a vineyard will carry wild yeast, and only 1 in 4 of those will actually have fermentative Saccharomyces on them.
Oh, wow.
So it's not necessarily that easy to select. You can grow a whole bunch of stuff up. You can get a whole load of bacteria. You can get a whole load of molds and other fungi. You can get yeast that are non-fermentative. Have to go through some selection to actually get any fermentative Saccharomyces. And so, yeah, there's steps there that you can do to try and isolate that.
I mean, could you potentially, I guess, like harvest the bacteria and then just add Saccharomyces to it to get the same result?
Yes. The bacteria tend to be a lot easier to grow.
right.
But there's risk there because not all of those bacteria are going to be good for you. Generally speaking, having the yeast there will clean things up. Again, anything, if you've got lactic acid bacteria in particular, that anything that will drop the pH below 4.5, once you do that, most pathogenic bacteria, most bacteria that produce off flavors are dead.
Right.
And so that's why we drink beer, because it's pretty hostile to anything that is pathogenic or might produce toxins. And, you know, there's an idea that civilization occurred because we learned how to ferment things.
Oh, and for sure. 100%.
And there's also the idea that, you know, did we domesticate yeast or did yeast domesticate us?
Yeah, right. So with that being said, you know, we're talking about all of these different, mm-hmm. you know, ways in which we can harvest yeast and how mm-hmm. difficult that actually is yeah. in the grand scheme of things. And coming around and talking, you know, about a lab, what mm-hmm. are the what is the equipment that home brewers could reasonably mm-hmm. go and procure?
Well, the first thing you need is a space to work in that you can have some degree of control of that isn't having people wander past all the time, air just blowing in from anywhere, a relatively clean space to work in so that you're not continually contaminating whatever you're working with.
Right.
But a lot of it can be relatively simple, even with the kind of equipment you have already, in that you can get some grape berries that look like they have something growing on them. You put them ideally into something like a grape juice first, because that's more like what they've been growing in. If you put that straight into wort, you might have problems because they've never seen maltose, they've never seen maltitrioses, they don't know how to deal with them. They'll eat the glucose and the fructose, but then they'll stop.
Right.
Now, that might actually be a good way for isolating a diastatic yeast, because that will just continue to munch on everything until there's nothing left, and which actually be a good way of determining you have a diastatic yeast. Now, whether you actually want that or not is another thing entirely. if you're specifically after fermentative yeast, the next step would be to use a wort with hops in it. You put about 15 IBUs of hops in there, and most of those bacteria will be gone. It's only if you have something like a lactobacillus that can adapt quickly that you might have them survive. And it is surprising how quickly a lactobacillus or a lactic acid bacteria can adapt. There was a study done that showed it only takes about 10 generations for a lactic acid bacteria to adapt to the highly acid conditions of a sour fermentation. And this isn't mutation. This is all this stuff, the ability to adapt exists within their genomes already. And so 10 generations might sound like a long time, but for a lot of bacteria, if they're growing under ideal conditions, they can double every 20 minutes. So it's not necessarily that long.
Right.
But equally, if you take away, this is actually adapting to the presence of hops. If you take away the hops and the antimicrobial effect of those, within 10 generations, they will have adapted back to not being hop resistant.
Huh.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, in reality, it's funny, like, wort in and of itself is equipment.
Yes, yeah. And all you're looking to do there is try and keep it as clean as possible. And so one of the ways to do that is just a domestic pressure cooker and bottles that you can autoclave without the lid melting. Usually that's the plastics that melt. So you can, and a lot of this stuff you can, the bottles and things like that that you would use in a lab, you can buy them on Amazon. Amazon has a whole scientific and industrial section. So a lot of the stuff you can just get there. And the beauty of it is that, say you're looking for a bunch of 10 mil pipettes, instead of having to buy a whole case that will probably last you a lifetime, you can just buy one pack at a time.
So, nice.
Things like that. But yeah, so you could make some wort, you autoclave it, you're guaranteed that there's nothing else growing in that. Because wort you normally make in your, you know, in your home brewing is sanitary, not sterile, which means if you just left that wort, there's a chance something would eventually grow up in it.
Right.
You know, you've got things, spores that can survive boiling and all that kind of stuff. So if you sterile,
like a pressure cooker, yep, like pressure an cook. Instant pot would,
yep,
be
absolutely
just fine.
Yep. Just put it on the high pressure. You do it for 15 minutes and you guarantee pretty much everything's dead. Spores,
so at that
everything.
Point, it's sterilized,
it's
not
sterile.
Sanitary.
Yep. And so you put into that, and then what grows is guaranteed what you put in. Now, if you then do the next stage, you do wort with hops in it, and you don't need a lot because you're now, you know, you're cooking this at 15 PSI, 121 degrees Celsius. And sorry, I will be using Celsius because science.
we use freedom units here.
Ah, does that mean I'm using communist units?
I don't know. It depends. Who created Celsius? Well, Celsius.
Oh, it's the French, I think. So yeah, probably communist. Where was I? Yeah, so it's you're going to get every bit of conversion of the IBUs there. So normally in a normal boil, you may be getting, what, 20% conversion? If you boil it, if you autoclave it, you're going to get everything.
Nice.
So, but you only need about 15 IBUs. You know, you're not worrying about aroma or anything like that at that point. You just want it to kill any bacteria in there, and then all you would be left with is yeast. So the next thing you would need to really be looking at this and seeing whether you have yeast or bacteria or both is a microscope.
Right.
And they're not too expensive. There's a guy, you look on Amazon. I looked the other day just to check the one I bought about 11 years ago now, which is still working perfectly fine, was about $350.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And all you need to be able to get times 400 magnification, so you need a times 10 eyepiece and a times 40 objective lens, and that'll give you that 400 times magnification. And with that, you will be able to see yeast very clearly. And with a trained eye, you will also be able to see bacteria. And that, again, is that's where some of this can get tricky, because you can't see what you don't know what to look for.
Right.
And I've had people of the same level of experience of me who've looked under a microscope and not been able to see bacteria because they've never been taught what they're looking for. And once you show somebody, you can't not see it. But until you actually know what you're looking at, is that just a bit of schmutz? You know, is it some hop debris? Is it some protein flock? Or, you know, what's a bacteria and what isn't? But there's lots of resources on the internet where you can see pictures which will show you what those look like in comparison to a yeast cell. So you can see size-wise how much smaller they are and that kind of thing. But that, you know, you take a sample of your first wort that has no hops in it and you look under it and you will see, maybe you'll see your yeast, hopefully you'll see your yeast. If you detect gases coming off, you definitely know you've got something fermentative.
Oh, for sure.
You won't necessarily know whether that's the bacteria or the yeast. You could have a heterofermentative lactic acid bacteria that is producing some CO2, or it could be the yeast. But you look under a microscope, you see what you have there, you put that in wort with 15 IBUs or so, and then you look at it again, and all those bacteria will be gone. And now you have your yeast. You're probably going to see a bunch of different morphologies under there, different shaped yeast. They could be round, they could be oblong, they could be in chains. You know, it's all going to depend on what you have there. But if you're okay with a mixed culture, then you can just go ahead and use that. Your other test, and this what we're talking about with the sensory kind of stuff is your other test is just to sniff it.
Schmell it.
If it smells bad, you're probably best throwing it away.
And what would smelling bad mean?
I'm just rancid. You pretty much know when you smell. If you smell it and your head flips back, then, you know, that's throw away.
Right, like garbage, essentially.
If you have you're starting with a nice clear wart, but you start getting some very weird colorations in there, that could be secondary metabolites off of some weird fungus, then throw it away. It's better safe than sorry. You can always start again.
Absolutely.
Or you can start again with your cultures. You can't start again with your own life.
You can't start again with your own life.
So, you know, just...
I mean, true.
You don't have to...
YOLO!
You don't have to keep, you know... trying to isolate or whatever. If it's not looking good, just throw it away, start again somewhere else, with something else.
Yeah.
But other than that, you can then go into your wild fermentation. And there you can look at things like how well does it ferment? You can do some small scale fermentations. If you're starting off with a, 1040 original gravity, but it's only dropping to like 1030 and it won't go any further, then you probably have a yeast that doesn't know how to use maltos or maltitrios. If, like I say, if it goes all the way down to 1.000 or below, then you probably have a diastatic yeast that's eaten everything. And again, you have to decide whether that's something you want to play with or something, if you're making a Saison, might be great.
Yeah, for sure.
If you're doing anything else, maybe not what you want. Then you're looking at, how do you maintain these? There's all sorts of stuff where you can get tubes, you can make agar, you can do slants. And that's a bit of a pain. But I did find a paper from the 1930s. Where they did a study on how to try and maintain lab cultures of all kinds of fungi. And it's an incredibly stupidly simple method. Basically, you grow up your culture, you spin it down, or if you don't have a little mini centrifuge, which you can buy a little benchtop centrifuge for 15 mil tubes for about $70 off Amazon. It's not great built, but you're probably going to be using it, once every couple of months or so. It'll last you years. Mine has. And you'd let those yeasts settle out. You pour off the liquid, get it as dry as you can, sort of thing. And then you just resuspend it in sterile distilled water and store it in a sealed tube.
Very cool. Sorry, y'all. We have a busy shop this afternoon. Go ahead.
And I tried this out. I was isolating some cultures from a local winery last year and doing a lot of what I've just talked about. And I decided to try this method. And I resurrected them a year later, and they all grew up fine.
Oh, awesome.
So it's an incredibly easy method to do. Now, I don't know whether they'll last for 2 years or 4 years or 5 years, but it's an easy thing to subculture them once a year and just make a fresh stock. It's also a handy thing to do that from your very first initial culture to stock that, because every time you use that culture after that, it is going to change. Because you have just isolated yeast from the wild where it has never seen, particularly if you Malthus. Start using it in wort, it's never seen that. Mm-hmm. It is going to start adapting. It is, unlike most modern brewer's yeast, it is unable to mate with itself or anything else or form viable spores. But this is a wild yeast, just out of the wild. It will be able to mate. It will be able to self-mate. It is going to be juggling its genome to adapt to these new conditions. And so each time you use it, it is going to change. And eventually...
Which might be like cool just to see how it changes over time.
Exactly.
Anyway.
And I remember having a conversation with an owner of one of the yeast companies and asking them this question, and they thought for a while and they said, interesting question. So it's not really something anybody's looked at, as far as I know, is how do the genomes of these yeast change as you keep selecting them over time. I mean, that's where the yeast we have has come down to us. They've been continually selected generation after generation, some of them for hundreds and hundreds of years now. Just keep taking the yeast. At the time, nobody knew what they were doing. They just know if they took the frothy stuff and reused it, it would ferment again. The other thing you're going to notice is that most wild yeast are probably going to be phenol or flavor positive, or POF plus. This is because it's actually a defense mechanism for them in the wild. A lot of yeast will grow in places where there's a lot of certain precursors, especially one of the known niches of wild yeast is in the bark of oak trees and other trees. And there, as the lignin breaks down, you get a lot of cinnamonic acid and things like this, which are toxic to yeast. It's part of the defense of the tree against infection. The yeast have developed this ability to turn those compounds into volatile phenolics, which then come off. And we smell them as those, you know, depending on what it is, it's either the spicy phenolics of a hefeweizen type yeast, or it's, you know, your Band-Aid and things like that. Partly depends on what the precursor is, and partly depends on the background and conditions of that yeast. So that's something you potentially are going to have to deal with and decide whether you that phenolic off flavor is acceptable in your beer, and maybe over time it will adapt away. That's how we got all the brewer's yeast we have. Over time, brewers selected for batches of yeast that had less and less phenolic flavor, and now we have most of our yeast that are don't have that phenolic character. I believe actually hefeweizen yeast were back selected for that at some point. Somebody got some yeast, which is the precursor of our hefeweizen yeast. It had that spicy character, thought, that's
liked
nice
it enough.
And
yeah.
So they selected for that, and now we have that yeast. So so I think there we're at, you know, microscope, maybe a little benchtop centrifuge, an autoclave, some glassware that you can autoclave media in, and make sure you're working with sterile conditions, that, you know, you're not selecting anything that's in your environment or in the wort you originally had, but is actually you're selecting what you're trying to isolate. And the water method as well, that works for bacteria as well as yeast.
Mm-hmm.
So I've selected lactic acid bacteria off of grain.
And oh, neat.
I have a really nice lactic acid culture that it sours real fast. I use it for my kettle sours and things like that. Has a nice kind of citrusy aroma to it. It's relatively easy to do. I have put that onto plates and done, you know, selection for single colonies and that kind of thing, but you don't necessarily need to do that. You can use that, you just store it, do that water method, just store it there, resurrect it, use it, and reuse it.
Very cool. In regards to folks who want to learn more about this and potentially like go out and get the equipment and all of that jazz, what literature is out there that can help people learn more about setting up their own lab and doing this process at home?
The book I recommend to everybody is the Yeast, the Practical Guide to Beer Fermentations. It's a Brewer's Publication book. Jamil, I don't know how to pronounce his second name, Zainashev, and Chris White. That's the starting point that I used. I may know how to set up a lab for producing, you know, human biotherapeutics, but I didn't. What did I need to for a lab specifically dealing with beer and wort and the bacteria and the yeast that we might find in that. It's a different set of methods. It's a different set of media. But that goes through all the techniques. It goes through all the media and explains what they are and what they do. And so that is good for both a home brewer and for anybody setting up a lab in a brewery. It adequately covers both areas. If you're looking deeper than that, if you want to know a lot more about the yeast and bacteria, I would thoroughly recommend looking at the Milk the Funk wiki. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of really good stuff there. It's curated by scientists, a bunch of the folks. Go take a look at the websites of like Omega Labs or Escarpment. They have some really good stuff in there as well. Good blogs. Escarpment, particularly during COVID, did a whole bunch of educational webinars, which were really, really good. Again, that both homebrewer and professional brewer can benefit from going and taking a look at those things.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Fermentality and that this conversation inspires you to brew your best.